Canto 3, Chapter 11, Calculation of Time from the Atom. And we're on 36 and 37. That's 37 on the board. Okay. So I'll just read text 36 and then we'll do 37. Tasyaiva chante kalpo bhud yam padmam abhichakshate yadhare nabhisarasa asiloka sororuham. The millennium which followed the first Brahma millennium is known as the Padma Kalpa, because in that millennium the universal lotus flower grew out of the navel reservoir of water of the personality of Godhead, Hari. And there's a short purport by Srila Prabhupada. The millennium following the Brahma Kalpa is known as the Padma Kalpa, because the universal lotus grows in that millennium. The Padma Kalpa is also called the Pitri Kalpa in certain Puranas. I am tu katitad kalpo. Dhiyasya pi bharata. Varaha iti vikyato. Yatra sich chukaro hari. I am this.
But
katitaha,
known as
kalpaha, the current millennium, dvitiyasya,
of the second half,
api, certainly,
Bharata,
O descendant of Bharat,
Varahaha,
Varaha,
iti,
thus,
Vikyataha,
is celebrated,
Jatra,
in which,
Asit,
appeared,
Shukaraha,
hog shape,
Hari,
the personality of Godhead. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. O descendant of Bharat, the first millennium in the second half of the life of Brahma is also known as the Varaha millennium, because the personality of Godhead appeared in that millennium as the hog incarnation. Purport. The different millenniums known as the Brahma, Padma, Varaha, Kalpas appear a little puzzling for the layman. There are some scholars who think these Kalpas to be one and the same. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the Brahma Kalpa in the beginning of the first half appears to be the Padma Kalpa. We can, however, simply abide by the text and understand that the present millennium is in the second half of the duration of the life of Brahma. All right. Today's the codicil, yeah? We had a devotee in Australia. His name was... that will come to me in a minute. Anyway, Ramprasad. I remember waking up one time when we were in Adelaide and he rolled out of his sleeping bag and he said, I bet today's a codicy. He didn't know, he was just the way he felt. So, a codicy is a heavy day. He just, you know, felt the pressure from a codicy. Alright, so, a couple of mentions here about millenniums. There's frankly not much to talk about unless we start talking about Lord Varaha, which I'm not going to do. Hare Krishna, Kapil Pritam. So I'm going to do the next verse as well, because there's a longer purport there. Kalo yam dwi paradhakyo nimesha upacharyate avyakritasya yanantasya yanade jagadatmana atmana. Translation. The duration of the two parts of Brahma's life, as above mentioned, is calculated to be equal to one nimesha, less than a second, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is unchanging and unlimited and is the cause of all causes of the universe. Purport. The great sage Maitreya has given a considerable description of the time of different dimensions, beginning from the atom up to the duration of the life of Brahma. Now he attempts to give some idea of the time of the unlimited personality of Godhead. He just gives a hint of his unlimited time by the standard of the life of Brahma. The entire duration of the life of Brahma is calculated to be less than a second of the Lord's time, and it is explained in the Brahma Samhita 548 as follows. Yasyaika nishvasita kala matavalambya jivanti loma vilaja jagadandanata Vishnu mahansahiya yasya kala vishesho Govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. I worship Govinda, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes, whose plenary portion is Mahavishnu. All the heads of the innumerable universes, the Brahmas, live only by taking shelter of the time occupied by one of his breaths. The impersonalists do not believe in the form of the Lord, and thus they would hardly believe in the Lord sleeping. Their idea is obtained by a pool fund of knowledge. They calculate everything in terms of man's capacity. They think that the existence of the Supreme is just the opposite of active human existence. Because the human being has senses, the Supreme must be without sense perception. Because the human being has form, the Supreme must be formless. And because the human being sleeps, the Supreme must not sleep. Srimad Bhagavatam, however, does not agree with such impersonalists. It is clearly stated herein that the Supreme Lord rests in Yoga Nidra, as previously discussed. And because he sleeps, naturally he must breathe. And the Brahma Samhita confirms that within his breathing period, innumerable Brahmas take birth and die. There is complete agreement between the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Brahma Samhita. Eternal time is never lost along with the life of Brahma. It continues, but it has no ability to control the Supreme Personality of Godhead because the Lord is the controller of time. In the spiritual world there is undoubtedly time, but it has no control over activities. Time is unlimited, and the spiritual world is also unlimited, since everything there exists on the absolute plane. The duration of the two parts of Brahma's life, as above mentioned, is calculated to be equal to one nimesha, or less than a second for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is unchanging and unlimited, and is the cause of all causes of the universe. All my possessions for a moment of time. That's a quote from Queen Elizabeth I. From England. She reigned for 45 years, which was considered to be a long time in those days, in terms of the British monarchy. It was very rare for somebody to last more than a few years because there was always people attacking them and bumping them off while they were dying from horrible diseases and things like this. So Elizabeth I lasted 45 years, and that was her final comment. All my possessions for a moment of time. So, in perspective, compare that now to this description. We've just read through the whole overview of the duration of the universe, all the cycles of yugas, the millenniums, the manus, and finally up to Lord Brahma himself, living for trillions and billions of years by our calculation. And all of that is nothing. Yeah. If anybody could say all my possessions for a moment of time, it would be Lord Brahma. Because all of his possessions apparently are the whole universe for its entire duration. So if anybody can make a claim, it would be him, nobody else. But even he is nothing compared to the situation of Lord Sri Krishna, who is the controller of time. So here it's nicely explained then that eternal time is never lost along with the life of Lord Brahma. So last week it was mentioned that unless you have some space, you can't measure time. That's how we do it. It's all relative. You have to have something to fit everything into. If there are movements going on, then you relate them to other things, other objects around, and you measure them. So past, present and future, it apparently moves along, and you have something beginning here, and it's kind of like a linear idea, although in the Bhagavatam the idea is given of cycles. But in any event, there's some kind of a measure, and by observation, particularly from oneself, because of course, you know, everything is subjective, at least from our point of view. So we measure everything in relationship to ourself. So we look and see how long we live. It could be this, you know, one individual self or an extended self, the human race. And then we measure, you know, the rest of the universe. This is how scientists are doing it. So they try to estimate, you know, how long the sun planet has been around in the universe, or even they try to estimate how long the universe itself has been around. And it's all relative to how they consider themselves. Yeah, because I consider myself to be this body, then everything that I observe is related to this body. So the progress of time is also related to this body. So the duration of the universe, billions and millions and trillions of years compared to the duration of this one body. It's inconceivable. You can't even capture it, even in a small token, what that really means. And therefore Prabhupada used to criticize the scientists all the time that they're talking in terms of millions or, you know, billions of years, but they themselves are only living for, you know, a few decades. So in other words, what is your power of observation and how will you calculate all of this? It's simply not possible. Yeah, it goes beyond the capacity of any living being to understand it, except maybe somebody like Lord Brahma, or, you know, those souls who were so elevated that they remain with him on his planet when all the rest of the universe is put to destruction at the end of the day of Lord Brahma, and then brought forth again at the beginning of his next day. So they observe. So from their point of view, you know, seeing even the flow of a millennium, or, you know, let's say a kalpa, which is one day of Lord Brahma, a mahakalpa, like 1,000 cycles of yugas. For them, if you're up on Tapaloka, Janaloka, Satyaloka, that also is just, you know, it's like watching the seasons go by. Yeah, oh, now it's spring, now it's summer, now it's autumn, now it's winter. So they're watching, you know, whole destructions and manifestations within the universe going by like the passings of seasons. So, you know, that's their perspective. But still, when you come to compare yourself to Krishna, how will you do that? If by comparison to other objects in the universe we can't even understand what it is, yeah, then how will we understand ourselves in comparison to Krishna, who is above all of that, and for whom, you know, the duration of a life of a Brahma is less than a second? Because even that we're trying to express in words. We use less than a second, but there is no time for Krishna because he's the unlimited, eternal, supreme personality of Godhead. So what then is time? Time is simply relative. And in the spiritual world, time is related to Krishna. Time in the material world is movement. Yeah. If there's no movement, you wouldn't be able to measure anything. So time is simply the measure of the movements of the living beings within a certain space. But when you get into the spiritual world where there's no limit, then how do you measure it all? Yeah. It's impossible. But still, it's mentioned there that time in the spiritual world does exist. Prabhupada's saying that it does exist. It's not that it ceases to exist, you know, with the destruction of the universe. It's just that you have a different reference point, that's all. And the reference point is Krishna, and Krishna is unlimited, he's eternal. And Therefore, the movements of the living beings are all measured against or in relationship with Krishna. In other words, the relationship with Krishna is life. Yeah. If you take yourself as the point where you measure everything from, then in the spiritual world, what is the self? Yeah. As I mentioned, in the material world, we say the self is this body, and we measure everything in relation to this body. If you want to get to the point of the real measure of time, you have to understand what the real self is. That's what the Bhagavatam is explaining, that the real self is also eternal and is not, you know, any manifestation of this temporary material universe. The real self does exist. When the body is destroyed, or when the planets are destroyed, or when the universe is destroyed, the living beings themselves are not destroyed. The time goes on, the reference points remain. Krishna is the ultimate reference point, and the way that we measure it is from ourself, in the same way that we do anything else. So the measure of a living being's existence is truly realized when he understands the existence of the eternal Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then he sees himself as an eternally related living being with that Supreme Living Being. And then he acts accordingly. Yeah. Because we all act according to our sense of time. Yeah. If we think we've got lots of time, then we dawdle along. And if we think that we have very little time, then we rush. Yeah, we regulate our activities accordingly. So in spiritual life, we regulate our activities according to our understanding of ourself in relationship with Krishna. If we fully understand our relationship with Krishna, then we'd be like Srila Prabhupada. We won't waste any time, because time is eternal. You are perpetually engaged in activities that are pleasing to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's devotional service. Yeah, that's the motivating factor. That's what pushes along and guides any devotee. That he's just simply thinking from one moment to the next, you know, what his activity is, whether it's pleasing Krishna, whether he could be doing more for Krishna. So you see, like Srila Prabhupada, he didn't used to sleep. Oh, he did a little bit, but just that was, you know, a requirement for the body, but it wasn't a requirement for himself. He had a conversation once, I think in Hyderabad, a man was asking Srila Prabhupada about just, you know, reducing. Prabhupada was talking about reducing the material propensities, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And so this man, he was thinking about that. He said, but is it possible to reduce sleep? I mean, you know, how do you go without sleep? The Prabhupada said, yes, it's possible. If you're on that platform, it's possible. He said, of course, some little for the maintenance of the body, some resting is there. But actually, you know, from what I observed with Srila Prabhupada was that when he rested, it wasn't the same way that we rested. You know, we would go to sleep and then, you know, you're either in total ignorance, forgetfulness, or you're dreaming or whatever, but, you know, you're just completely, you know, out of awareness of everything else that's going on at that moment. You know, you have your 6 or 8 hours. But with Srila Prabhupada, you know, he would lie down, and it was just like, you know, you park your car, let the engine cool down a little bit or whatever, and then after an hour you switch back on the engine and away you go again. You continue, you know, with what you're doing. Prabhupada would sleep for maybe an hour and a half in the evening, an hour after breakfast, and an hour after lunch. And any ordinary, you know, health enthusiast will tell you that if you only have that much sleep, then it will be, you know, it will destroy your health. Yeah. If you don't get the right amount of sleep, then it disturbs you mentally, it disturbs you physically. You know, it's just not good for you, like that. Because that was... The deprogrammers used to criticize us for that. That we deprive our followers of sleep. Yeah, because we only get 6 hours or 7 hours like that. This is putting us in a state, you know, where our mental makeup you know, becomes fragile, and then we can be easily controlled, brainwashing like this. So this is one of the techniques of Korean brainwashing, that, you know, we deprive our followers of sleep. So they can't understand that on the transcendental platform, these things like sleep, eat, mate, defend, it has no meaning, because all of that is in relation to the body. And in the material world, of course, you have to do those things just to maintain these bodies. There's certain functions, the senses work in a certain way, they come in contact with the sense objects, and they more or less have to be engaged that way. But on the spiritual platform, it's a totally different reference point. You're simply working for the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, not with any consideration of this body. And the body simply becomes an implement, you know, for a devotee to express that devotion. So sometimes he can go, you know, many days and nights without any sleep whatsoever. We read sometimes about great devotees, just like Gaurakishore Das Babaji. He would go, and sometimes he would just pick up a lump of, you know, earth from the banks of the Ganges and eat that. And somehow or another he was living. How you can do that by just eating a clod of earth? But he could do that because his body was just an instrument, that's all. And with the spiritual potency that was manifest there, Krishna was sustaining him. Krishna was sustaining his body for him to do his service. So for Krishna, anything is possible. He can transform, you know, a lump of earth into suitable, you know, foodstuffs to sustain this material body. The six Goswamis are only living on a few drops of buttermilk, Prabhupada said, every few days. Yeah, how you can do that? But it's possible on the transcendental platform. But if we're absorbed on the material platform, then that's a whole different reckoning. Yeah, as soon as we get shut off from that spiritual side of life, then we become confined by the space that we're living in. In that space, you know, the different sizes of universes. For Lord Brahma, he's got the whole of what we call the greater universe, but our universe can be just this one body. We get confined within it. There are so many other living beings in here with us, and we're the predominating deity of this particular body that we're in. Yeah, and it has its duration of life. And there are certain obligations that as soon as you accept this body, that you have to do in order to stay within it. Just like Lord Brahma, he's also obliged. He has to do so many things to maintain the material universe. But all of that maintenance is actually unnecessary. That's the point. If you really see what the actual self is, if we really understand that we're, you know, eternal spirit souls, then the whole question and consideration of what to do with this body changes. Your whole priority completely changes. If we realize who Krishna is, of course, if, you know, you may realize you're not this body, you may realize you're not part of this universe, but if you don't realize Krishna, then you may separate, you know, and see that, oh, there's no necessity for maintaining myself materially. But if you don't realize who Krishna is, then what will you do? Then after some time, again, you have to take up some kind of material activity, because you don't have anywhere else to go. You remain confined, even if you think that you're liberated. Lord Brahma was critical, you know, of those Mayavadis who think, somehow or another, by some mental adjustment, that they become liberated from their material obligations. Just by, you know, understanding I'm not this body. But because they don't get a glimpse of the lotus feet of Krishna, that little cowherd boy that's running around in the forests of Vrindavan, because they don't have any understanding of him, then they're obliged to come back again to material activity. There's nowhere else to go. We can't be inactive. That's the nature of the spirit soul. So it's a question then of getting a reference point. You can't remove one reference point without replacing it with another one. Yeah, in order to fulfill one's nature, we have to know what we're related to and how because that's the only way that we can know how to act. Why? Because we're subordinates. We're not supreme. We're not Atmaramas. in the sense of being self-sufficient. We can't just simply sit and decide to do whatever we like. Yeah? Our minute position, our subordination obliges us to act in relation to some other object. So whether we make that the material universe and everything that's in it, or something else, that depends on our education, what we know, what we understand to be the self. So this is the first business, that one has to get a proper sense of who we are and why we're here and where we are. And then we can decide what actions we have to take. And if we don't do that, then we're madmen. Prabhupada said that in the beginning of the Nectar of Devotion. He says, I think in his introduction, he says, everybody in this material world is more or less mad. And that's not an exaggeration. Yeah, because nobody knows who they really are. And that's the definition of madness. Yeah, when you're forgetful of yourself, you do all kinds of crazy activities that, you know, may become destructive to your own health and well-being, or destructive to the health and well-being of others. So out of madness, you know, when a person becomes mad, they become too mad, what do you do with them? You lock them up. Yeah. So everybody's locked up in the material universe because they're all mad. They've forgotten who they really are. They've forgotten that they're actually the servants of Krishna and that their business is to please the senses of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They've forgotten that reference point. They've removed him and replaced it with something else. And then they're obliged. You have to work. Nobody can refrain from doing anything, even for a moment. That's what Krishna tells Arjuna, one of his first instructions. You want to retire from this activity, but you'll have to do some other kind of activity. You can't refrain. So it's not a question of, you know, not doing this or doing that. You have to find out what the right action is. You have to act. So that requires some education. Raja Vidya, Raja Guya. Yeah. Krishna then begins to inform Arjuna what your real position is, what your real identity is. And then you can be successful in life. So the Bhagavatam then is giving this kind of overview of time. Not that, because, you know, the Bhagavatam is particularly concerned with the material world. It's the Amala Purana, you know, the spotless Purana. It has no inebriety. So why is it giving descriptions, you know, of the material universe? We're not interested in that. Yeah. If we're aspiring transcendentalists, why would we be interested in calculation of time from the atom? So this verse answers that question. It's to give us, you know, some perspective, you know, to take us out of our limited perceptions, you know, of how we're situated. Yeah. Gradually, all these verses have been, you know, expanding the horizons, if you read through them. It just expands your horizons to an unlimited degree. Yeah, up to the level of understanding the lifetime of a Lord Brahma, which is inconceivable. And then, you know, even that's put in this perspective that it's less than a second compared to the existence of Krishna. So that's the point. It's a glorification of Krishna by comparison. Yeah. If we were all fully pure devotees, then that means, you know, we don't have any material inebriety, we have no covering over our consciousness, then we would just be enjoying with Krishna. We wouldn't need to worry about this kind of stuff. Yeah. But in our situation, where we do relate to, you know, all the material objects around us, we are trapped in the time-space continuum, as they say. Then we need these comparatives just to expand our horizons, just to broaden our knowledge and bring us to this point where we can get a little glimpse of what it means to be unlimited, eternal, yeah, without any, you know, check in any way whatsoever. So Lord Brahma then, yeah, one nimesha, less than a second. There's no real seconds in Krishna's time. Yeah, they don't have a clock on the wall in Goloka Vrindavan. Yeah, it's just activity, that's all. Krishna's having his pastimes, he's playing with his friends, you know, he's having his relationship with his mom and dad, he's going out into the fields, he's going into the jungles at night with the gopis, whatever he's doing all these things. It's just going on, and you can't measure it. There's no day, there's no night, there's just moods, that's all. And it's described as if Krishna has a day and a night, just like they have this kind of meditation that at a particular kind of time of the day, you can meditate on this pastime of Krishna, or on that pastime of Krishna. But that sense, you know, of having a particular time of day or night, is just, it has no meaning in terms of the way that we conceive time. Yeah, it's not like there's a past and there's a future. All the activities are going on all at the same time, unlimitedly. And that's inconceivable. So just to give us an idea of inconceivability, these different measures of kala chakras, yeah, the kala chakra for an animal, the kala chakra for an insect, the kala chakra for a human being, the kala chakra for a demigod, the kala chakra for a great sage, the kala chakra for Lord Brahma, they're all described here in different ways. Just to, you know, give us some kind of perspective on our own situation. And then ultimately, of course, you know, to come to the conclusion that we are not products of this material world. We exist, as Prabhupada says there. Eternal time is never lost, along with the life of Lord Brahma. So, what is time? It's a measure of the movement of a living being. And that's not lost. Even if the universe is destroyed, it won't be lost. The living being is eternal. And his relation with Krishna is also eternal. And that's the key point to it. So in our devotional service then, we try to become timeless. Yeah? We try to act with a sense of just simply what pleases Krishna. That's all. That is the rationale for all life. Yeah? Just pleasure. The pleasure principle is the underlying principle of all activity, all movement of life. And the ultimate pleasure then is to please Krishna. Okay, we're going to finish at that point. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Do Lal Chandra Prabhu.
The Lord Chaitanya refers to a moment's association with the pure devotee. What time frame is he referring to?
It could be eternal. It could be less than a second, depending on how the living being takes advantage of it. Actually, contact with a pure devotee or contact with Krishna has an eternal effect. So it can't be measured. And in that sense, that one little point of contact, it may act over a period of lifetimes, but it will bring that person to the point of devotional service. It might not be, you know, visible immediately, but eternality in terms of lifetimes is yeah. So we may get a contact with a pure devotee now, but it apparently may not have any effect on us. But actually there has been an effect, because, like, just say the holy name is transcendental. So when a person hears the holy name, it actually activates them on a spiritual platform. It cuts through the three modes of material nature. It cuts through all the conditioning, and it directly affects the soul proper. So now, he may not immediately be able to respond to that, but at some point in the future, because he's had that contact, he's had that glimpse, he's had that taste of Krishna, that will come out at some point, and he'll try to understand what that is. He's had that experience. So that one moment in time may be, you know, a few lifetimes. Or it could be instantaneous. Maybe, you know, somebody sees, you know, a pure devotee and then immediately becomes attracted and feels, I have to serve this person. Some devotees had that experience. When they saw Srila Prabhupada, they just immediately wanted to serve him. They just knew that that's what they had to do. But some people, you know, it took a little while. I mentioned last week about Gopijana Balaba. Remember him. When he first saw the devotees, he started throwing rocks at them. Because he heard the holy name and it actually, you know, agitated his heart. But he didn't know how to deal with it, and he was so covered over at that time. You know, his immediate response was to, you know, push it away somehow or another. So he was throwing rocks at the devotees. But then later on, he realized actually this is something very nice, and then he became a devotee. So, you know, how time affects us and what a moment of time is, it just depends on your reference points. Does that answer the question? Yes, Guru.
In the spiritual world, the place is not fixed. Sometimes for dissipation of the yoga, some distance becomes shorter or longer. Similar is the time. But in there, like here, like one night can last from around the day.
You can't measure it, that's the point.
But this example is given that Krishna was performing the asana.
Yes.
And it was one night, which is extremely long time.
That's again, it's a comparative. Yeah. That narration is for our consumption. But on maybe the heavenly planets or on the Vaikuntha planets, so it may be a different, there may be a different way of narrating it and understanding it. We have to use the language that we have. And we have to use, you know, the reference points that we have or can understand. So we understand, you know, the passing of a day and a night. You know, that's our, you know, that's our problem, is that we always want to measure everything. This is the scientific nature. Just like in the Bhagavatam, it's not chronological. Because chronology is completely unimportant when you're talking about spiritual topics. The only thing that's important, and therefore archaeology, is just a bunch of nonsense. Yeah. Oh, how you understand the past and the history of mankind by digging up artifacts and bones and, you know, it's all nonsense. And it has no value, even if you could actually chart it all out, you know, as they like to try to do. But what value does it actually have? It has no value. The real value comes in the theme, you know, in the experience. And what is the meaning of that experience? So in the Bhagavatam, it's all about experiences. It's thematic in one sense, but it's not chronological. So that tendency to try to measure things, you know, that's born from our conditioned nature. In the spiritual world, nobody bothers about that. You're only bothered about whether you're pleasing Krishna or not. That's it. That's the bottom line. And then there are so many different varieties of activities that are going on all the time, everywhere. You can't measure it. You know, we talk about a Goloka Vrindavan planet, but if it's unlimited, then how can you talk about it as being a planet in the sense that, you know, we understand a loka, you know, in this material world, like this, you know, little speck of dust that we're on. Goloka Vrindavan is unlimited, but so is Vaikuntha Loka also. So how can you have, you know, some unlimited planets? It seems like a contradiction in terms. It's just to help us, you know, get a sense of what's going on there, that's all. Is that all right? Go on.
Some years ago, National Geographic did an article on the Angkor Wat Vishnu Temple.
Nassau's taking photos of the bridge from India to Sri Lanka. There's videos that this fund has on the real remains of Dwarka. So these are all kind of like archaeological expeditions. When you say in Christian service that archaeology has helped them give some validity to what we're saying?
Everything has validity if it relates back to Krishna. But if it doesn't bring you to Krishna, it has no validity whatsoever because it's not part of reality. So archaeological endeavor, all right, if you feel a need to do that kind of thing, dig up things and try to guess, you know, who lived here and when they lived here and what activities they were performing and what were they eating and all this kind of stuff. But what's the use of that unless it actually brings you, you know, to the transcendental platform? But if from a transcendental platform, I mean, in one sense, that, you know, these descriptions that are given in the Bhagavatam, they have a validity because they lead to Krishna. Otherwise, you know, what's the point? You're lost in time and space. So whether you're on this planet, or part of this dynasty, or that dynasty, or, you know, this species or that species, it makes no difference in the material sense. But everything makes, you know, has a point, it has a value as soon as it's related to Krishna. So, you know, if somebody immediately believes in Krishna and engages in Krishna's service, you don't need to explain things in a lot of detail. They experience it, and that's what it's all about. And as long as you stay on that platform, then your life is perfect. But because we're, you know, very conditioned and complicated, and we've made things, you know, our minds and our intellects, everything has to be, you know, grasped and measured and computed. And so, therefore, so much effort has to be made in order to explain things in detail. But just to bring you to this point, yeah, that after explaining everything about all the different cycles of time in the universe on different scales, and finally coming and getting this mind-blowing, you know, description of the length of time that a Lord Brahma lives, to come to this point that says, and he's just living less than a second compared to Krishna. Him and so many millions and billions of other Brahmas are living less than a second. They're just in the breath of Lord Vishnu. How will you understand that? Nobody can understand, you know, the breathing, just even the breathing of the Supreme Lord. What to speak about if he actually gets up and does something. The yoga nidra is more than we can handle. You know, what to speak about, you know, Krishna's actual activities with his pure devotees, you know, in Dwarka, Mathura, and Vrindavan. Therefore, we're cautioned very strongly not to try to jump straight into Krishna's transcendental pastimes. Yeah. First of all, you have to understand the magnitude, you know, of Krishna's existence before you can really appreciate Krishna himself and what it means to be with Krishna, to have, you know, personal exchanges with Krishna. So don't jump, you know, straight to the 10th canto. Go through the first 9 cantos. Get this conception, you know, of the magnificence of Krishna first. Get a little glimpse at least. Yeah. And then when you actually come to read about Krishna's activities, you won't mistake him to be an ordinary man. You won't mistake his activities, you know, with the gopis to be just some kind of excuse for sexual pleasure. Now, how can you do that with you, you know? But there are people Sahajas in Vrindavan. Prabhupada used to, you know, mention it quite frequently. They just take Krishna's activities in Vrindavan as an excuse to justify their own, you know, misbegotten ideas of what pleasure is. And if you talk to them, you know, about these sections of the Bhagavad, oh, that's just another Krishna. That's not our Krishna. Our Krishna's playing with the gopis in Vrindavan. Yeah, in the forest at night time. But this Krishna, you know, the Mahavishnu aspect or the Narayan aspect, or the Kurukshetra Krishna, or the Dwarka Krishna, or the they're all different Krishnas. They'll tell you that. There's only one real Krishna. But actually, have you really understood who Krishna actually is? So it's just, you know, to take us to the right point in our understanding, to get us out of our, you know, mental frameworks and intellectual frameworks. Any other questions or comments?
Srila Prabhupada was expressing something like that while studying in Vrindavan, and he was saying where such and such, and they said, oh, is that he'd be here tomorrow or he'd be here tonight, Prabhupada. Prabhupada said something like, from my perspective, there's no, now for me there's no meaning of, you know, day and night or today and tomorrow. Prabhupada said something like that.
I didn't hear that specifically, but I mean, at the point that at the point where Prabhupada was in, you know, like say the last 6 weeks in Vrindavan, his preaching leelas had finished. That means that, you know, he was now reposed completely and wholly in his, you know, his relationship with Krishna, spiritual. The preaching activities, you know, that requires you to, in one sense, come down, if you like, to the material platform, because you have to see, you know, what the time, place and circumstances, and you have to present Krishna consciousness, eternal activities, but within a time frame, and, you know, within a circumstantial framework, time and space. So you have to tailor it to that, and you have to take into consideration, you know, people's habits and cultures and lifespans and all these different kinds of things. But when you retire from that preaching activity, that's the position of a Mahabhagwat. Yeah, he doesn't see all these differences and measures and things. He doesn't see them anymore. So, you know, if Prabhupada said that for me there's no time. Yeah, that's because now he was fully absorbed on the highest level, and he'd retired from his preaching activity, and therefore the obligation, you know, to see things in terms of time, it was no longer there for him. Okay, we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.